That's all from me. Only leaves for me to ask you to give a very warm welcome, please, to our guests this evening, David Ransomman, and to Danny also. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening, everyone. Oh, it's quite loud. It's a great pleasure to welcome Danny Dorling to the Cambridge Literary Festival. Danny is, as I'm sure you all know, Professor of Geography at Oxford University. He's the author of far too many books to list, so I'm just going to tell you about the one that we're going to be talking about now. You can see part of the cover up there. It's got a great cover. Peak Inequality, Britain's Ticking Time Bomb. This is the only slide, right?
So we'll, it.
This is it. So at some point you can talk to it whenever you think it's appropriate. I just want to start. We're going to leave masses of time for questions because there's lots that I'm sure people are going to want to talk about. So you actually, the title, you pick up on it in the book, you call it a time bomb, and you say it's ticking, and it's particularly ticking loudly for the rich. Mm. So what would happen if it blew up? What's the kind of image here? What should the rich be really scared of?
Oh, so many things. they are. I mean, in a way, it's already gone off.
That was going to be,
yeah.
So it blew.
It blew. And it, you can't be sure. When you're at a peak of inequality, it's actually a moment of, you know, it goes up and down, up and down, up and down. 20 years after a peak, you know you've been at a peak, but this feels like a peak. If I was, say I had £20 million, what would I worry about? I'd worry about the government coming in, who would properly tax the two or three homes I had in London. I would worry about the income tax rate that I would be being asked to pay at some point in the future. The rich are certainly worrying a bit about pitchforks and so on, although ironically they're worrying about pitchforks from people who voted to leave, who tend to be fairly old. So I don't think they're going to get the pitchforks, but you never know. Unpredictable events. More seriously, the country no longer being a safe place for property. A safe place in which to do banking, a safe place where people know their place and the order in which things move a little bit one way or the other, but in general you're okay. Unpredictability. I read novels very, very slowly. So the novel I'm reading very slowly at the moment is Brideshead Revisited. And if you work in Oxford, it's fascinating. The allowance of the student, was negotiated at £450 a year, which is actually almost the same as the salary of the professor of geography back at the time, which shows you what a different world we were at the last peak. This is just after the First World War. But you can tell how far I've got through the book. It's when they're describing this as a ghastly age, a terrible age, because the norms of having servants, your own scout, the norms of being treated in a certain way when you go out to dine, all of that appears to be coming to an end. And for most of the very, very wealthy the last time, their reaction to the first kind of 20 years of decline from the peak was they were pretty much against it. Very few had imagination to actually see the advantages. John Maynard Keynes may have been one of them. I mean, he was a wealthy man. William Beveridge is another one. He went to rugby, was born out in Bengal, I think. Tawney was another one, but there was a tiny number of people amongst the very wealthy the last time we were at a peak who saw the benefits. Most people didn't, and I think we'd like that again. It's not about history repeating. It's just that the only thing we've kind of got to go on is that this last happened around the time of the First World War. And the bad news about a peak is that in the immediate aftermath of a peak, it isn't suddenly everything's okay. Your inequality levels are still incredibly high. When they come down with the benefits and salaries of the income of the poor coming down very fast too. They come down with homelessness spreading in the streets. They come down with a general sense of despair, and we don't know what's going to happen. Passing a peak of inequality isn't a joyous moment, but at least it's a peak. And it's good to get there, because otherwise you are heading for something even worse, and eventually an even bigger crash.
So you say in the book that the rich seem to believe, and this is the penny that maybe hasn't dropped yet, that the lifestyle that they want to protect depends upon inequality underpinning it. And is that the sort of psychological barrier that, in a way, is the hardest one for them to overcome? You say that you know, a few far-sighted people see that actually to defend their way of life is to recognize that it cannot be underpinned by this level of inequality.
Yeah.
But the implication is that very few people who are living that life see it.
Very few. I mean, the people who originally become very rich tend to be men, tend to be fairly bloody minded, and they never see it. The grandchildren of the rich are more magnanimous, in general, are more often likely to see this. I promise I won't mention the last time again, because I mustn't do this, but the Russian Revolution focused mines. It actually, there was an option of being put against the wall and shot. And we don't have that.
Don't have that option.
We don't have that option or that fear at the moment. But what I wish, I mean, what I wish I'd done more in the book, and it's really hard to do, is to get people who are pretty wealthy, and if you want to know what my idea of pretty wealthy is, there's £2 million there. £2 million just for you. Not £2 million spread out amongst your family, but you've got £2 million. To get people in that situation to realise that for those they care about, their friends and their family, their children and their grandchildren, their friend or their grandchild who does worse in life will be better off in a more equal society. It is actually in their interest. And trying to get that through is quite difficult. The other thing which is new this time, and I'm sure it's happening in Cambridge, it's certainly happening in Oxford, and of course it's centred in London, is for the super rich of the world, this country has become a bolt hole. This is where you put down the last few million somewhere safe, in a big house, wrapped up in a company to try to avoid stamp duty. You don't care that house prices have fallen since August 2016. Although they might fall by another 10 or 20%, that doesn't mean anything to you, because this is the last of your money. This is the money that needs to be there in four or five generations' time. And this part of England around London and the more affluent parts, have been altered by that. And getting people to realise that that isn't safe. The idea you'll be allowed to buy something in Kensington Palace Gardens and leave it empty, and not have to pay £700,000 a year for the common good, that penny has yet to drop. The idea that you can own fields on the edge of a city and hold on to them forever because they're protected by being part of the green belt and won't necessarily be compulsory purchased at agricultural price, that penny is dropping. In this case, the super rich are colleges of my university who are trying to sell that land for the first time in centuries, as they realise it's changing. But it's this sense of possibility. I'm optimistic about what's going on. I didn't like what had happened for 40 years before. I saw a slow ratcheting up of the divides between us. I saw life for people who were in the middle becoming harder and harder, and then life for people who were just below the top 10% becoming much more difficult. Becoming a situation where you had to get yourself into enormous debt because you have no choice but to get a university degree. We don't live in the kind of country where you actually are free to do different things, more equal country. And then you have to go for that job in London because that job in London is the only one which has a career structure which will give you a chance of getting into the top 10%. And so you have to pay that landlord the enormous amount of money for the room in the house with five people you don't know that you have to share through all the way to the time when you're 38, if you make the mistake of not finding the boyfriend or girlfriend who actually has family money. You know, and I'm talking about the problems of somebody who is above 9/10 of the population. You know, it had got to a ridiculous extent. I can, well, not happily, I don't like doing it. I can talk about what's happened to people in the bottom 10% of society, which, you know, makes the problems of people like me and those I know pale into insignificance. I had to do a talk in my school I went to on Valentine's Day, And what I had to work out in my head is whether I tell the children in that school, it's a absolutely average school, does fine, 200 kids go to university from it. Whether I tell them that in the last month, two children who had gone to that school, now aged 42 and 49, had died homeless on the streets of the city. And that if things carried on getting worse and worse and worse than where they were, they should look around the hall and think, who amongst the 15 and 16 year olds here is going to be the person who dies in a tent or a halfway house in the city in which they grew up? That didn't used to happen, and that has got worse. And so it's envisioning the beginnings of the end of that, which I think is optimistic. But you don't just snap your fingers and it gets better. Yeah, it takes longer.
So we'll talk in a bit about how it might change. So one of the things you do in this book, you said explicitly you're mapping inequality. I mean, that's one of the things you do. And you need to buy the book. There are lots of fantastic charts and graphs and depictions of this. So one of the things you just touched on there comes through really strongly, which is London, in many of these representations of the country, is this kind of bloated, extreme thing that sucks in money and people and opportunity. So how unusual are we as a country to be so divided by our capital city from the rest of the country?
For the rest. I mean, this is why I got into this. In the 1990s, I was measuring small differences and making a big deal of them. I criticised New Labour at the beginning for slightly not making things better. I mean, it felt very important to me. Whereas this is different. Greg Clark, the minister, produced some statistics and didn't even understand them himself, and this is what shocks me on how unusual we are. The only equivalent country near to us for the dominance of a capital city compared to the rest is Russia and Moscow. That is the only equivalent. And I remember Greg Clark putting this slide up, the figures were there but not presented that way. In the Guildhall in London, and saying, look at what a success London is. And it was partly our blindness to realising what had been going on. Increasingly, to take university graduates, remember half of all young women go to university, so it's no longer an elite thing. Every census from 1971, the proportion of university graduates going to London rose, as the absolute number rose. So it was sucking in like a vacuum pump where the pressure was being put higher and higher and higher. And you go to high streets in Wigan or up in Sunderland or in Gloucester and you can see the effect. We did a report, me and my colleagues, 10 years ago for government, trying to look at all the various things that might predict whether a city does well or badly, and produced a big computer model, a regression model. And only one thing came out. How long it would take a train in the morning to get to a London station to arrive at 9:30. That predicts the economic success of your town. The further you are away, the less the GDP had risen, the worse the unemployment was, the earlier people died, and it had tightened up overnight. And even tiny things, like Hastings having to have a sort of loop and change trains, kind of explained why Hastings was bad, or York having that special fast train that doesn't stop. You know, I mean, it got to a ridiculous point in this country where all that mattered was the success of the capital and of banking and of the satellites of the capital. And this is a satellite, this could be a London borough for all intensive purposes. And the rest was going to live off the largesse of them. George Osborne had a target he never publicised. And the target was that London should be the most expensive large city in the world. It took me ages to realise this until a senior civil servant told me. And I said, why? I just looked a bit shocked because George had been talking about help to buy and so on. He said, well, the market tells you. The market tells you that if the price is highest for you, you're the winner. And the market will sort out who can be there and who cannot be there. So if you wondered how or why this happened because the people in charge believed it was good it happened and even instigated schemes like Help to Buy 40% guarantee of the government. You buy a pokey flat in Hackney for £500,000, you've only got to find a 5% deposit. We will collectively guarantee, after the first 5% fall, by the way, which has already happened, the next 40% fall in house prices, we're going to pick up the tab. That's what Help to Buy was. And what's the purpose of it? It was to put a floor under the housing market. And it's all these kind of ridiculous things, but when you look back at them, why didn't anybody shout? Why didn't they say, what are you doing? And they just said, oh, don't worry, house prices never fall. How can you imagine an event which could possibly damage the reputation of the United Kingdom or the success of the City of London? That will never happen. Yeah. It's ironic, but we're getting the beginnings, I think, of a feeling that we're in a different time. And it isn't a happy feeling, it's an uncertain feeling, it's kind of a bit queasy. I suspect the more you've got to lose, the more worried you'll be, and the less you've got to lose, the more you're not going to be that bothered about it. But it's certainly absolutely different. But the last thing to say about this is, we adapt really, really fast. So it's quite hard to remember how fast things have changed. One way to look at fast adaptation is how people behave within a year or 2 years of the start of a war. You become used to the fact there's a war. Try and take your mind back to 2005 or 2006 in this country, and what were the major priorities? What were the things in the news? What did the BBC show? At the end of the BBC news, regularly, several times a year, there would be a story about the success of a particular bank, in which there would be young men wearing Armani suits in London opening one of those really large bottles of champagne, while the business editor would talk about how the share price had gone up. That really happened, it's in the archives. And it wasn't that long ago. That's the difference that we've had.
So, in a way, the bigger question here is, how much should we think about this as an unusual time? Or how much should we think about this country as an unusual place? Because there is often a narrative here which is, the story about inequality is one that applies across the board. And maybe we're slight outliers. But actually, I think when you read this book, it does not feel like we're slight outliers. It feels like, in some respects, with housing, with education, the way this country has operated for 20, 30 years is very unusual, not just historically, but in relation to other developed nations.
We became exceptional. One problem is that so much social science, and particularly economics, is done by UK and US-based academics. And so if the people writing about it happen to be living in a place that's changing, and you don't notice change, and then what we do is we say, oh, it's happening everywhere. So one thing I do in the book is I look at everywhere else.
You look at France, for instance, and a country that people tend to think of now as, well, they've got their problems too. But France. Structurally, we're nothing like France.
We're nothing like France. In France, the median family, is on €5,000 more a year. That's a massive difference to your life. €5,000 more a year. The cost of housing is less, and you've already got €5,000 more a year. If you have a third child, the government will pay you enhanced child benefit, which is the opposite to no child benefit now here. Your health service, the number of doctors per head, the number of empty hospital beds waiting for you to sit in. The amazing thing about France, or the brilliant thing about France, because all countries are different, what the French are really, really good at, exceptionally good at, is protesting. And one way in which you get this is by protesting for it, and protesting the minute you think you're losing some of it. But for all the EU 28 countries, bar occasionally, because I'm a pedant, so I've got to say, bar occasionally the odd Baltic country once, it's a number, bar them, we are by far the most economically unequal. And to achieve that out of 28 when you're a large country is really, really difficult. It doesn't happen by accident, it requires a project to get you there. our best, I should explain, the red line at the top.
We would get to that.
You can explain more. This graph is particularly, because if any of you get bored, just look up Fraser Nelson's Twitter on your phone. He decided to spend a large part of his morning this morning, if not all of it, claiming that I've made this up. Because he believes that inequality...
This is the editor of The Spectator.
Yeah, yeah. He believes that inequality is falling. The red line is the take of the top 10%. People like us, university professors. And we take the best of 10% of people in this country, 40% of all income, leaving 60% to 9/10 of the population, which is why Cambridge looks like it does. Why, if you were here early in the morning, you could see who's coming in to empty the bins, how far they're coming away from, and so on. It's that income distribution that actually shapes our towns and cities. It has not been this bad since the 1930s or before, and it is not as bad as this in any other country in Europe. It's quite exceptional. I can go most expensive, lowest quality, most pokey, most precariously rented housing in the European Union. We can compete if you want. On statistics, the highest homelessness rate, street homelessness rate. The only similar country is Germany, and the only reason that Germany even compares to us for street homelessness is 1.5 million Syrians coming in, and the number of them who are actually sleeping in tents still underneath flyovers. The school system. Nowhere else in Europe spends a third of its education spending on secondary education on just 7% of children. It just isn't done. You know, we have the health service still. What's left of it? What actually hasn't? The hospital nearest to me, the John Radcliffe. NHS England, this is a story, I don't know if it's been reported nationally. NHS England, a couple of days ago, it was revealed, were not letting the hospital explain what was going on because they sent lawyers' letters saying it would be defamation of the private company was trying to take over the cancer screening so they could do cancer screening in a car park with the profit going to the company. I mean, the pulling apart of that. If we wanted, I'll end on this, I could just go on, but because I've been doing statistics for 30 years, and the reason I get wild is I began my career with really tiny differences. And now I have to say, if you want to spend what the Germans spend on their health service, to get what the Germans get, you need to spend an extra £1 billion every week. That's the figure that matters, it's £1 billion a week. How do you get £1 billion a week? We'll go on to it, but you know, the fact that you might be sitting there not knowing how you get it shows how different we are from the rest of Europe. Other countries in Europe provide far better services, a far more even distribution and spread of the income, not necessarily the wealth, and that's interesting. But they get their wealthy to behave and not to flaunt their wealth and not to pay their children too much. So you can actually have quite high wealth inequality as long as you have a society that makes sure everybody is paid a similar amount of money and people are not allowed to behave in bad ways.
So can I ask you about something that you wrote about here and you've written about quite a lot elsewhere as well, which again is something I think people tend to associate, as far as they're aware of it, with the United States, which is mortality rates.
Yeah.
And something that's happened really strikingly recently, which is decline in life expectancy. Yeah. There's also a question about infant mortality too.
Yeah.
And also then you have some figures about sort of deaths in custody, people who've been detained under the mental health act. So there's a whole range of things, but you write a lot about death, and measuring death really matters. So just tell us a bit about what's happened to death in this country in the last few years.
Okay.
There's more of it.
There's more. Well, we're the only country in Europe in which life expectancy is falling.
It's falling in the United States.
Yes, it's falling in the United States. And it'll be interesting to look around the West. It'll only be falling in a tiny number of places. You'd be amazed how high life expectancy is in India now. We're the only one where it's falling. It first became evident in 2013. There was a whistleblower who was shut up in the northwest of England working in the NHS. Published an article in the New Statesman, which is, I think, downstairs, February 2014. And saying and this is a shock comment, elderly women over 85 are living 2 weeks less. That was the story that I was shocked by. Elderly women over 85 are living 2 weeks less. I was shocked by it because it had not happened for years. And you could see the Meals on Wheels being taken away, the social worker visits taken away, and you can see the connection. The next thing I know, I get an email from Public Health England asking me to explain all the inaccuracies in this report. Rather than say, yes, there's a problem. And so I send them back a copy with the 30 references to all the data, and they just go quiet. But it's this reaction of when you see something wrong. Now, that was 2014. I won't take you all the way through it, I can. But a couple of months ago, the Institute of Actuaries, who really know what they're doing, the people who monitor the pension funds, the Institute of Actuaries came out saying life expectancy for both men and women in total has fallen by over a year. And I was worried just 5 years ago about 2 weeks. Now, I mean, the good news is the pension funds look solvent, right? In fact, 300 billion liability has gone off some of the private pensions, reported in the FT, I think 2 years ago. This has accelerated. Private pensions. Who has private pensions? Is this better off people as well dying? Who gets to 85 or 83? It's actually better off people. The infant mortality. When I was born, we were about the best in the world. We had the baby incubators, this is the 60s. By 1990, we had the lowest neonatal mortality rate in Europe. It's pretty good, six countries better than us, 1990. You know, after the whole of the Thatcher period, which really did start NHS. By 2015, we dropped to 17th on the European league table. And the rate we were going, countries like Portugal had long overtaken us. The rate we were going, by about 2025, 2030, Romania will do better in terms of infant mortality. And the babies who are dying are the babies of English-born mothers. It is not the immigrants, because immigrants are young, fit, skilled and healthy, and make up a third of midwives in the middle of London. Since 2015, the official ONS infant mortality rate has risen each year. Actually gone up absolutely. So we're no longer talking about a relative difference. We're talking about more grieving parents in absolute numbers. The reaction of the British establishment so far is that the BBC More and Less programme did a look into this and said, oh, we think there's just been more premature births. Now, there hasn't. There were premature births over the rest of Europe and they managed to save them, and there were issues about brain damage and so on. There may be slight differences about whether you designate that a newborn is stillborn or a birth. All of this matters. The kind of thing I have to do in my job is I have to go through the numbers of every infant who has died at 22, 23, 24, 25 and 26 weeks gestation each year to actually work out there's been a dip in the 25, 26 and 27 week gestation. So this thing is real, because it isn't more stillbirths being dressed up as. But the fact, I'm a geographer. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not the chief medical officer. I'm not in a department of health. How have we got to a point where the country can have statistics that are this bad, and when they get worse, rather than looking at it and acting on them, what you get is a reaction saying, oh, it isn't that bad, stiff up a lip. Yeah. Come on now. That is the kind of arrogance you still get at the peak of stupidity. I think we're at the peak of stupidity as well as inequality. Trying to hold on to the idea that things are actually okay. You know, why am I worrying about people dying at 81 rather than 83? Yeah. These are hard times. So what if somebody dies a couple of years earlier? That is the kind of attitude out there. Incidentally, the biggest group who died is elderly women. Elderly women are more likely to die when the state falls apart because they're more likely to be on their own. Men, on average, in the past would marry a woman 5 years younger than her, and she lives 10 years older. So men get cared for in old age, on average. Women don't. The profile, the age profile of the women, not just the age profile, social profile, is exactly the same as the women that Harold Shipman targeted. Right? Except this is many, 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 many shipments. But it's just overall neglect. The main cause of death is dementia and Alzheimer's. It's not that we're getting more dementia and Alzheimer's, we will get that, but not yet. It's that people who have dementia and Alzheimer's now are more likely to die faster than if you've been lucky enough to be born 10 years earlier and have your dementia and Alzheimer's before we lost so much of the care. That's what's going on. Must get me off it because I just can't stop when I start.
I'm going to ask two more questions. I'm sure there'll be people who A, will want to know what we can do about it, but maybe might want to push back. I don't know. It's pretty bleak so far.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask one non-bleak question,
yes.
Which is, so inequality is not a single thing. It can be measured in lots of different ways. On many measures, it's at a peak. It's been getting worse in the last 20, 30 years. Tell us about some of the ways in which it's been getting better. In what ways do you think we're a more equal society than we were 30 years ago?
Oh, huge numbers. Huge numbers. I mean, in general, there is progress. It's just like I'm a kind of homing beacon for bad. And most of the world, I mean, forget, the majority of the OECD countries have got inequality drops now. Most of the world is getting more equal inside each country. And people often can't believe this, but it's what's in the statistics. Infant mortality outside. We currently are looking at the biggest improvement in infant mortality ever that there will be in the history of the species, because it cannot improve any faster than it's improving now. At one point a few years ago, it dropped by 10% in 1 year. There comes a point of one baby dying per thousand that you can't get any better. So there were lots of positive stories. Inside Britain, I can still go from, I can remember the 1970s when racism was so bad that you joined the police because you wanted to beat black people up, and Asian men, when I was young, were regularly stabbed to death. We have a rise now. A friend of mine tweeted an event that happened this morning in London to me, but it's nothing like what it was, and the middle class would be mortified to be called racist, which is a very useful thing to have. Tolerance of people with varying sexualities is absolutely incredible, especially in schools. I'm absolutely amazed by the spread of tolerance within schools in general, schools of all kinds. Lack of violence in schools. We had the most violent schools on the continent. You thought it was just fighting in the playground and it was normal, but it turns out it wasn't. That has largely ended. Our overall levels of violence are down, our murder rates, for all they say about the knife crime and whatever, are down. And the biggest change is the changing position of women, which is two men sitting here is a bit ironic to say. And the nice thing is, whenever you say it, somebody will tell you, don't you know how bad it is? And a bit like the French, that's how you get it better. But the change, my university, last year, for the first time ever, 50.2% female. And we should have been there 20 years ago, okay? Because that's what a normal Western Group university is at. But the fact that we now worry that we're only 50.2% female, we really ought to be about 68. The changes that you see working through in terms of the relationship between men and women, that I think the biggest one. But there's a lot more. The stuffiness and the arrogance and the snobbery that I saw in my youth has reduced. People don't want to be seen as a bigot, even if within them they are one. You know, it's not a kind of good way of getting your message over, so you try and be chummy. There's probably lots I've forgotten. The attitude of young people, I think, is also very interesting and appears to be changing. Quite how this has happened, whether it is a reaction against a generation that's portrayed them, I don't know. We are almost a kind of Thatcherite loads of money generation. A whole set of people of our age made a bit of money in the 80s, got the ethos of, you know, you look after yourself and you're 50 and you'll do okay, and if people don't, they're bad. I mean, the tragic thing is, that some of those people are now the ones who are dying because of lack of a welfare state. But that's gone. My only parallel is when you see betrayal twice, then you lose your faith in the old. My grandfather was born in 1916, and the First World War was widely perceived to be an utter cock-up by the upper classes. It was supposed to last weeks. But, you know, you can make a mistake. But when he was sent with his friends to fight in France and Germany, they never forgave the people who didn't prevent that war happening. And when they came back, they changed everything. Now, this isn't like a war, but you bang on £9,000 a year in 2012 student fees, having promised to abolish them if you voted a certain way. And you appear not to care at all about the climate, and you're xenophobic and hate immigrants, and all the things that in the schools the children are not, the country is. And this seems to be a very good way of galvanising a generation to actually take action and not trust older people to do it. And I think the last time that happened was 1945-46.
Last one from me, and we can do this briefly or more lengthy. So you touched on it a bit here, but one thing that might also impact on this story is we're living through a technological revolution. Digital revolution, which is producing both new inequalities but also new kinds of sharing. So, you know, a new inequality in our world is, I think it's roughly 7 million people still in the UK who are not online at all, mainly older people. Yeah. And when you think about how many services now are dependent on being online, that's new, that's a sort of 10-year story. On the other hand, most online services, including commercial offerings from the social media giants, are free.
Yes.
And in some level that's redistributed, and yet we're living in a world where Jeff Bezos has just got a divorce settlement, and both he and his wife are happy. Yes. He's just got $35 billion. So there's, I mean, do you think that there's the possibility that there's a kind of whole new wave of both equalities and inequalities being driven by this technology that could shift this story again? Because you, as well, you're describing
a slower arc. It's not just the 7 million are not online. Government minister recently criticised young people for paying for a basic phone rather than eating. But a teenager will make sure their phone works before they make sure they eat. You have to. It's your social connection. So you know, that is new. Although, you can go back a century ago, Seaborn Rountree, Joseph Rountree's son, who was the last of the Poverty Survey of York, worked out a whole series of things that people had to have. How much food, he wouldn't let them have any alcohol in the budget. He would let them have chocolate from his dad's factory. But he had all these items that you had to have. And then he added one item which wasn't necessary but is what you should have if you're civilised. And that was enough money to buy a stamp, a one penny stamp. And he wrote, it was very sweet, he wrote, to be able to write a letter to a loved one. And that was 1899, published in 1901, I think. Lloyd George waved the book up. So that enough money to buy a stamp to write a letter to your love is very similar to having to check Snapchat. You know, in some ways we did
similar.
In some ways we did. I'm personally optimistic about technological change. I think it is much, much slower than we think. There are huge vested interests that tell us it's very fast. The 747 was born at the same time as me, 1968. We are still flying in 747s, we aren't flying in Concords. I was a geek, I had a Windows computer as a child. You know, some things have actually slowed down. But the big change is access to information. I grew up in Oxford, and I was a geek. We had two libraries. The two libraries were the Central City Library, which was tiny, and Bowen Old Park Library. The university, I didn't realise at the time, I knew we had a lot. The university had 100 libraries, and you weren't allowed in those libraries. Still, we don't let local school children in term time. But it doesn't matter, because who wants to sit in the library now when you can access it all like that? Mm. And that absolute freedom for information from You know, I remember, I was geeky, 15, 16, 17, going to the city library, right, just off Corn Market, to a tiny number of shelves, because that's where the only place where the knowledge was, because it wasn't in the schools. That opening up is incredible. And, you know, I think it makes people powerful. I think it's hard to control people anymore. We controlled them in the past by not letting them go to past school, past age 14. Keep them illiterate. Then you can control them. Then we allowed people to read and write because we needed an expanded middle class. But it was a bit worrying. And now you can really find out things. And I think it's much more positive than the worry about fake news and sites, you know. Remember, over half of young women go to university in England. You can work out how to navigate your way around the web. You can work out that Google has targeted you for a particular advert, because it's so crass at the moment that 2 days after you've emailed something to a friend, it's very personal, Gmail, you get an advert for buying that item you're talking about. I am optimistic about it. I think it is good. We just have to work out. We're in the age of the kind of robber barons and the, you know, people owning entire railroads just on their own. You have to work out, how do you go about making this into a utility that is publicly and widely available while still letting somebody who officially owns Amazon or Google pretend they still own it? And that's law. You introduce a series of laws of ways you've got to behave. Still let the monopoly provider actually provide it, but don't let them charge too much, don't let them behave in certain ways. They'll do it, because they'll still make millions. Do not, I would say, turn it into a fake marketplace of competing small firms for what is essentially a natural monopoly utility. That, I think, would be the stupid thing. The era of competition is great for everything. And you want as many electricity companies as possible, because we love shopping around electricity companies every year. And you need different people to sell you water, even though it's coming out of the same pipe. All that stupidity is over. And that's what we need to look at for technology.
Great. Let's take some questions. There are a couple of mics. Should we take two questions at a time? Two or three?
Two.
Okay, so there's a gentleman there. There's a woman at the back with her hand up. Or we're coming to the front first. And then to the back.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Out of our political class, who gets this? Who understands this problem? Who wants to do something about it? And have they got any credible ideas? And who actually wants to keep the status quo?
Okay, and then at the back, there's a woman at the back. Keep going.
So I'm a student at Durham University in England, and you were talking about how a lot of young graduates move to London in the, because it's kind of almost like a vacuum for young graduates. Do you think there's any possibility of change in this, and do you think there will eventually be a sort of change in the demographic of graduates?
Yeah, okay. Okay, the first one on the politicians. A huge number of them get it, but they also get it's really hard to sell and explain. At the peak, we got 11% of people saying inequality is a major problem in polls. It's an ambiguous concept, the gap between you. It's much easier to say poverty matters, or good health service matters, or immigrants are making everything. But almost everybody in the Labour Party gets it. Caroline Lucas gets it, and it's in the Green Manifesto. Liberals kind of get it. They vary amazingly in that party, given how few MPs there are. The views vary. Sadly, I don't think many Tories who are left in the Tory party no longer get it. When I was young, there were One Nation Tories, and the couple of MPs who I kind of thought were, one of them, I was at a seminar in the House of Commons, talking about the infant mortality rates, and I won't name it because it's not fair. This is on the left of the Tory party at Grandee. He went, but Danny, it's only 3.6 per thousand. This is as we drop to the 17th phase and it's rising up absolutely. Only 3.6 babies dying for every 1,000 born. So I do think we've kind of lost the Tory party. I'll get on to decisions in a second. I'm really confused about Philip Hammond and about Fraser Nelson. Philip Hammond, in every budget speech, has quoted, or somebody's written it to the speech for him, inequality is at its lowest level since 1996. Now this is a measure which is called the quintile median range. It is essentially, if you take the best of 20% and the middle person then, and the bottom 20% and the middle person, and you completely forget the top 10%, who are member taking 40% of everything, and you completely forget the bottom 10%, which includes the destitute, then among that middle group, we have had a small rise in equality, as it's got shitter for everybody together. This is just ridiculous. Now, either Philip Hammond knows how innumerable the population is, and it's just a game, can I say it again and they won't notice? Or, and what I think is more probable, I think Philip Hammond thinks this is a reasonable statistic. And there are super talented people who should be paid a lot of money and they're in the top 10%. And there are wasters and you need them to suffer, otherwise everybody else might become a waster, so you need the bottom 10%. And the statistic which only worries about the middle 80% is actually a valid thing, because you look after that group if you're the government. There are many ideas that the most effective single thing that has been done across countries, Piketty and his colleagues showed this repeatedly, is a high top marginal rate of tax, not to raise money. And again, this is where I think the Conservatives are being more stupid than disingenuous, because they repeatedly say, oh, it won't raise you much money, and you go, yes, that's the point. The point of saying, I don't know, let's make it 90. Let's have a 90% rate of tax after you've got your first 4 million. Right? So if you're going to be paid another million, you're only going to get 100,000. And the board of the bank, because it's only a bank which will pay you 5 million, the board of the bank are going to hand £900,000 to the Exchequer to give you 100,000. What does the board do? Of course it won't do that. It just says, no, we can use that million to hire lots of people to do good jobs. What do? You don't even ask them in the first place, because it's embarrassing to ask. And countries which have high marginal rates of tax have lower income inequality. There's many other things you can do, but that is by far the most effective. And it is how Germany gets an extra billion a week to fund the health service. It is simply higher taxation. It also doesn't have rusty nuclear submarines that it is paying for, or builds an aircraft carrier to send down to annoy the Chinese in some sense of, you know, just trying to prove Danny's right about the stupidity. I don't want to be, really. I don't know, I sort of think, oh, they can't be this stupid. It must just be nastiness and disingenuous, but I'm afraid. I actually think there is some genuine, I don't know, it's sad to say so, but. And I think, well, I'll give you, sorry, I must make my answer short. Yeah,
because you've got another one to go for.
I've got another one. There's a motorway proposed between our two cities called the Expressway. It's a motorway between Oxford and Cambridge. It is, in effect, the first branch of the outer M25. If you look at Beijing, you can see the model. Why do we need a motorway between Oxford and Cambridge? Because we need to build, is it 300,000 houses in Oxfordshire? Double the number of houses in the entire county. Why do we need to do that? Because Empire 2.0, with the successful Brexit, is going to make London by far the most successful place on the entire planet, and we're going to need lots more houses for all those successful business people. That is actually the government plan at the moment. And it's not just this government. George Osborne, who you might think of as one of the more sensible ones. In 2015, George Osborne said, follow my economic plan, and by 2030, this will be the richest large country on the planet. They're obsessed by this, and as they've been obsessed by the question of Durham. It's a symptom of Durham has expanded as a university. So if you talk to the good people of the town of Durham, they're a little bit annoyed because the university has built halls of residence after halls of residence, and there isn't much more than the university in the city of Durham. So the problem is you can't stay in Durham. If you really like Durham, you can't stay in Durham because there aren't anywhere for you to live or anything for you to do other than teach in the university. You can go to Newcastle, which is well worth doing because I lived there for 10 years, which I would recommend. But we've re-engineered cities a long way from London to make them service points for London. You know, what Durham does and what Oxford and Cambridge do is give people a CV and a background that catapults you in to within the inner ring of the tube map. Yeah, that's in a sense. So we've transformed our geography of our whole country. It's entirely possible and necessary to move back to be normal. There are whole towns where the middle class is only the public sector providing services like the GP and the head teacher. And nobody who's got a degree is there if they don't have to be there. That's a recipe for disaster. The brilliant thing is that our inequality in this country has arranged itself such that the boring flat bit is rich, and the bit you actually need people to move to is the bits which are actually a bit hilly and look nicer. So I think it's far from impossible. But you've got to spend money on the rail service up between Sheffield and Leeds and Manchester and Newcastle so the trains work. You know, and if you don't do that, rather than building a second Crossrail just so that you can stick ever more people into a rabbit warren of the urban heat island in the capital.
Take a couple more on this side. Was everyone on that side? We go at the back? Yep. But no, behind you? Yep.
Hi, great talk. Encouraging as it is that more than half the students at Oxford, I think you said, are female. Are you convinced this is an indicator of greater sexual equality, or is it not just rather progress for the daughters of a particular social class?
Don't do that.
I'll go for
that one. Last year, the University of Oxford produced the most detailed statistics ever, which were damning, but at least we produced them more detailed than any other university, I think. They come out about May 23rd, the new ones this year, so it'll be interesting. I think what has happened is actually certain families tried a little bit less desperately hard to get their son in. The importance of getting the boy into the particular college, because father, grandfather, father-in-law had all gone, was paramount, and I think it's actually that reduction. But certainly when you look at the social class of the girls, they're no less posh than the boys. There's a lovely visual graphic which compares the overlap between most common boys' name and girls' name in Oxford with the most common name for footballers and footballers' wives or girlfriends. And if you want to see social division in Britain, that kind of shows it. You'll know when things have changed, when places like the University of Cambridge and Oxford begin to change more dramatically. The last time that Oxford and Cambridge were unbelievably unequal, I think only 10% of the intake in something like 1922 came from children who had both been to a public elementary school and had not paid a fee for their grammar school. It's about 10% back then. We're currently on 60% state, but pretty posh state, and you've paid for it through the house price rather than the 2 shillings to the grammar. Between 1922 and now, we had a period, and we had Act of Parliament, when things got better in the elite universities. We got to a point in the 50s and 60s where people came in from working class backgrounds and grammars, and mixed and slept with people from the public schools. I'm a product of one of this. And it was possible in the 60s, and it wasn't even seen as unusual. Nobody talked about widening participation, maybe they did. And then what happened in the 70s and 80s was the inequalities began to rise. The top private schools, rather than send a third of the boys to the guards, a third to the city, and a third to university, the clever third university, moved because the parents demanding it, sending all of them to university. And not any old university, because you pay a lot of money. Particularly universities. It's that shift in the behaviour of the top private schools, particularly Longford. Did it Longford? Because the alumni pay better. And you see the inequality going up and up for access. The last few years, have been really interesting. It's teetering. It's getting better. Possibly this year may see, if you don't tell anybody else, may see the biggest single rise in state school children for many decades in one year. But there's always luck. The decisive thing that happened, your university annoyingly always beats us. And is going into, anyway, so you don't want to know about this. The best thing that happened last year was that the University of Oxford for the first time ever lost a letter. The letter was sent to Wellington Square by a grime artist called Stormzy. And Stormzy was offering to fund two students. And we lost the offer of the letter. He then contacted Cambridge and they took the money. What was brilliant about this is that it all came out in November, early November. The interviews of the many thousands of students occur late November. And the majority of the people interviewing last November were fully aware, because they read The Guardian, more than anything else, of the acute embarrassment that the university was in. How many colleges take a single black student? How many take two? How many have just three working class students? And which subject is the worst? On May 23rd last year, my department, the Department of Geography at the University of Oxford, with an intake of only 86 students, undergraduates, we featured three times in the Times newspaper in one day about the fact that our students' background was so undiverse. If the Times, bless them, if the Times put you in three times one day, you begin to change your behaviour. Now, we're going to have to do this for 20, 30 years to even begin to approach fairly elitist equivalents in the mainland of Europe. But we're possibly at the start of it. And the point is, you just got to keep it rolling forward. And that is beginning, but it requires the embarrassment as well. It's not just saying this is a good thing to do. It's the embarrassment of saying, which is the slowest university in the country? Which is the least progressive one? Which college of Oxford might be the most bigoted on average? And this is the same as it was when Weizen Visit was written.
We're running out of time. Take two more questions. So the woman here at the front and then the woman in the centre there at the back.
So we obviously talk about inequality, but at what point, I think everyone's generally involved in inequality. It's like, you know, for people to become judges or whatever, it has to have somebody to say, well, I don't really want my neighbour's child to come and do some work experience in my, you know, judiciary. It's actually to say, I'm going to take this random child from Hull or Liverpool or Manchester. It takes everybody to kind of say, well, I need to do something about the inequality of where I work. It's like, I had a student who wasn't doing very well, and then, but because her dad knew a solicitor, she managed to get work experience here. And it, you know, it's just, there's a lot of unfair, invisible unfairness. There's a lot of the glass ceiling that we're all involved in. We're all involved in, you know, going to the golf club and your friend that you do this with has a child and you're going to let them do there and they get experience. And these careers such as like journalism, the judiciary, the banking, they're places where you have this selection by your friends or your cousins or whatever, but people just can't get into it. It's just a closed ceiling. You know, when you...
Okay, wait, so, because we're going to have to take one more.
Okay.
You'll respond to that, Danny, and then...
I'll respond to that while you're on there. Okay.
One more, and then, because you're going to have signs and books. And
okay, yeah. Hello. As a young person, a lot of the statistics you've been reading out today certainly resonate quite true, certainly in terms of university fees and housing. As a young person, where and who do you think anger is best faced and best directed at?
Okay.
You want to, respond to both.
You're right, it's every day. I do it. I have had one intern who was the daughter of a friend. None of the others were, but they came from the posher state schools in the city. One huge problem is that in a really unequal country, it's quite hard to be magnanimous. So I'm not bothered about whether my kids are in the top 10%. But I'll do whatever I can in Britain to stop them falling into the bottom half of society, because the gaps are so enormous, and I will do that. While you've got parents behaving like that, trying so hard for their own children, you are basically stamping on the chances of others. It's chicken and egg. You need to bring the gap of income together before you say, yes, it's absolutely fine for my child to do something which is paid less than something else, because the less isn't that much less. In Switzerland, somebody who might clean your house is paid in Bern 30 euros an hour. Now, you don't hire a cleaner unless you really, really need a cleaner when you have to pay them 30 euros an hour. I think hardly anybody needs a cleaner, for God's sake, you can live with dirt. But you know, if you're really, really, really busy, you do that. You go out, this is Switzerland, where the bankers have paid half of this. You go out for a meal, it costs you a fortune, the person who washes up the plates will actually come out and say hello. That is the kind of thing you get. So it's got, you can't just be good on your own spread equality by your own behaviour. It is necessary, but you need the situation to be changed by a government who makes it harder for a small group of people to hoard, and also ensures that you cannot pay people poverty wages. That we don't have special low rates for apprentices because they're under 25. That we certainly don't take away people's benefits who are ill, for God knows what kind of sadistic purpose. Well, I can't see why they're doing that. Which gets me on to your...
So briefly, where should young people direct their anger and how?
You have to direct your anger at the party of inequality. The political party of inequality is a Conservative Party. There are then many things you can do, but I'm afraid it's become as simple as that. The party who are the most successful party, they claim in the world, but certainly in this country for the last 100 years, so successful that Margaret Thatcher actually altered the hearts and minds, including the heart and mind and soul of the Labour leader in 1997. That political party, above all else, has been the main driver of inequality because they believed it was good. They believed it rewarded talent. They believed that only a few people should lead and be at the top. They believed most people were ignoramuses and didn't have a clue. And they got us to this situation. The wonderful service they've done for the whole of Europe, if they've demonstrated what happens if you do this. So we provided a warning. I'm afraid I could be more nuanced about it. But for the time being, it is that party. When that party splits into two, there hopefully will be a nice and a nasty side. And the nice side, the One Nation, slightly petition, whatever, will not be the side that promotes inequality. The nasty side, all the kind of horribleness can go there. You know, just think what you'd put in that side. You know, that. But for the moment, I'm afraid this country has the political party which has increased inequality more than anywhere else on the continent. That, above all else, is the problem. Thank you.
Right, so, but two things. So first of all, where will people be able to...
Yeah, we will head downstairs. Heifers have a table downstairs in the hall selling the books. Next to that will be a signing table, which is where we will be. Please do come and join us.
Okay, so great. So the two things I had to say was, one, do that. Two, please join me in thanking Dan.